So here we are. We're in week three, session eight, I think this is. And I want to start by reminding you of something I also mentioned last time, which is we're zeroing in now on the timing of the retreat. I think I said last time, but I'm not sure, maybe not, that we have to change the timing. Yeah, this has come up before. So the retreat is scheduled for July 12th to 17th, and so I'd love for people to start thinking about your participation. Kathleen has been keeping me up to date, and we already have a core group that has agreed to participate, but or is planning to participate. But I'm hoping that more of you will be able to join us, and we'll keep you updated on that. So the retreat is July 12th through the 17th. Of next year, of course, and that means that we are postponing the start of session 12, which is the final session in the program, by 1 week. It will start on July 19th. And in fairness, I should point out that there are tentative plans for a TSK retreat in Europe, I think also starting July 19th. No, it's in August. It's in August, August 12th, something like that. Not directly connected with what we're doing, but those of you in Europe certainly would probably like to know, and those of you who might like a little trip to the continent. But that's not definite. I just heard rumors this past week. We are talking about time, and we're making a transition this week, really. Caroline is asking, where in Europe? In Holland. The plan is to do it in Holland. We're making a transition this week to, really, you could say, third-level time. So knowledge of time and space shares with the first TSK book this pretty strong emphasis on the three levels of time and space and knowledge. I think I've said in the past that just personally for me, I'm a little bit cautious about speaking in those terms because, and again, I'm just talking about my own reaction here, but it seems as though once you lay things out, then there's such a strong temptation to say, oh, that was a second level experience, or that was a third level experience, or something like that. And it's just, you know, the TSK vision is so clear about the importance of not turning TSK into a structure or a dogma, anything like that, that's my concern. Having said that, though, Rinpoche, especially in this book and in the first book, does talk a lot about TSK in terms of three levels of space and time and knowledge. So, you know, we'll take advantage of that. We'll use that in a way that hopefully will help clarify our thinking. So in this reading and the reading for next week, where the focus is on zero, the relationship of zero to time, we really are making a transition, and I'll try to say something a little later about the nature of that transition. First, I want to review kind of the second level approach we've been exploring, and then take a look at the beginning of the chapter and how that leads us into a practice that I think makes good sense for us to do here this week, to do in this phone call. So let's start with a review of where we are. And of course, you know, we've done so much, we've covered so much material, the review could operate in a lot of different ways. But what I want to emphasize here is this kind of fundamental issue that comes up in the discussion of time in the TSK vision, but really comes up whenever we try to activate a new vision. And the simplest way to say it, I suppose, would be to say that when you're looking in terms of the old vision, you know, when you're looking with your old eyes, it's very difficult to imagine what a new vision might look like. You're going to have an old vision version of the new vision, and making the transition is very difficult. In the Buddhist tradition, in the Mahayana, you talk about the Buddha and other practitioners developing the ability to see with different eyes. And they talk about it. I wasn't thinking about this in advance, but there's five different kinds of eyes, I think. The divine eye and the Buddha eye. And you see different things with each, you know, when you develop this new seeing capacity. And vision is like that, but you can't see with the old eyes what would show up with the new eyes. And that's very true when you're talking about time. The way that we talk about time is in terms of the temporal order, right? And in the temporal order, which really means the world that we inhabit, understood as in a kind of genealogical way. In other words, how did we get to where we are? So the world unfolds in a particular order. That's the temporal order. And time is always at work in that order. But it's at work in terms of how we understand it from within the order. And that has to do with past and present and future and moments that somehow link past and present and future or move from past and present to future. And there's some kind of transition. And we've looked in the past many times at the fact that this is very problematic. It doesn't really work if you try to analyze it. And so one of the approaches that Rinpoche takes very often is to do that kind of analysis, to kind of loosen things up by showing you that all our customs, all our presuppositions and assumptions really don't make sense. But that's not the approach we're taking here. Here we are really trying to kind of, you could say more directly, move into a different understanding, a different vision of time. So it's very difficult, and this is really the theme I'm emphasizing in these few minutes here. It's very difficult to imagine how that could be, because it's easy enough to say, well, how does the temporal order itself come into being? And then you say, well, if it comes into being, that calls for time, that takes time. So time is prior to the temporal order, but if you ask what that means, it's very difficult to know because time arises within the temporal order, but the temporal order itself arises. So what kind of time could give rise to that? And this is a more sophisticated version of a question that you see often asked. You know, at a certain point, children learn to ask it. It occurs to them. They say, well, you know, if time had a beginning, then what was there before the beginning? Or sometimes the question gets asked in terms of a creator, right? If the creator created the universe, who created the creator? Those kinds of temporal issues are what we're pointing at right here. So it's kind of a mystery, right? There has to be a time before time, but that before can't be a temporal before because of the before and after all have to do with the temporal order. So another analogy you might think of, and I'm not saying that this is the same thing at all because I'm not familiar with the tradition, but one of the koans that's used in Zen is what was your face before your father was born? Right? That seems to be pointing, at least when I see it from a TSK perspective, it seems to be pointing toward a time that's prior to time, or you might say an invariable time. So that's the concern, the issue that we have. And as we'll see in a little bit, it's not just a theoretical concern. You know, there's always a a danger in TSK, you'd say, well, okay, so I don't quite get it theoretically, but I don't understand how it would work, but who cares? Who needs to know that? And the answer, of course, is that this affects the way we live our lives. But I'm going to postpone that discussion for a little bit, because I want to go into the way that Rinpoche treats this concern, or how he tries to address it, this concern about how can we possibly engage a time that is not part of the temporal order, but that makes the temporal order possible. So how, the question is how Rinpoche goes about doing that. And what he does is it's a move that gets made in the TSK vision fairly often. You say, well, let's go to the extremes. Let's go to the smallest possible moment of time, or the first possible moment of time, or something like that, so that we can ask questions about the whole sequence and the whole order and the whole structure, how they all arise. And that's what Rinpoche does here at the beginning of this chapter. He says, let's take a look at the smallest possible moment. We don't really know, asking that question is in part dependent on some sense of what counts as a moment. And that's something that does get discussed in the TSK vision at different times. But here I think we're just taking a kind of ordinary understanding. We're saying, okay, we accept that time unfolds in terms of moments. Let's take a look at the smallest possible moment. So that's one extreme that Rinpoche is asking us to look at. And then the second extreme that he brings out is let's look at the entire content of that moment, right? All possible content of that moment. Klaus asks a question here: if zero is zero, how can it show up? Well, that's really exactly what we're looking at here. I'll give you a short answer in terms of what it says in the book. It says, what shows up as an echo of itself. Right? That's one of the many ways it's talked about here. So it can't exactly show up, but it can show up as its own echo or its own. So we'll look at that. Or you might say it could show up as the image in the mirror, although I don't think Rinpoche uses that particular analogy. So we're looking at the smallest possible moment, and then we're looking at the total range of all possible content in that moment. So we're going into extremes in both connections or both respects. We're the smallest and the largest, if you want to think about it that way. So Rinpoche talks here about the content. The total possible content of this smallest possible moment. He talks about it in terms of juxtaposition. And I actually thought that was pretty interesting. I've always been interested in the word juxtaposition, partly because Rinpoche is very playful with it. But I looked it up, in terms of the etymology. And you often learn interesting things by doing that. And so what I learned when I looked up juxtaposition, and especially the focus on the juxta, which is not a word that we use in English a lot, it comes from a root which essentially is the same root as we find in the word yoga. It comes from linking things together, which makes sense. That's what juxtaposition is. So there is a sense in which you might think of this as kind of ordinary everyday yoga. This is how we put things together. We get a unified view of everything. Another way Rinpoche describes that, I'm looking at, I think, somewhere here on page 89, he talks about the presupposed readout. That's on lines 2 and 3. We have the smallest moment, but we have the total readout, which is presupposed in that moment. And that is you know, the whole of the temporal order. So we've got these two things together. And that's what we're interested, or that's where Rinpoche asks us to explore in the beginning of this chapter. So by doing that, by calling our attention to the extremes in that way, I think Rinpoche is making this shift into the third level of time. Because the point that he really makes about these is that when you look at total content and when you look at the smallest possible moment in which the whole of the content, you know, the whole of the universe in a sense, maybe that's not right, but the whole of whatever is going on in that moment, when you look at those two things arising together, what becomes clear, what he wants to point to, is that none of that is ever established. And what you can say about that is that establishing, when you say, you know, this is true, this is real, you're saying, well, this has been established as so. And this goes back to Klaus's question, you know, you say, whatever shows up has to show up as having been established or it wouldn't be there. So then you ask the question about zero, you say, well, how can it show up? This is really what this chapter is exploring. So you have to establish something, but you can only establish something within the temporal order, because the whole point of the temporal order is that things get established within that order. The temporal order, which is, you know, you could say shaped by the logos, you could also talk about the field communique. These are some of the ways Rinpoche has talked about this in within the context of the TSK vision. The temporal order is there to set something up as the way things are. You know, that's what the temporal order is. This is how things are. And what that means is that the temporal order is all about establishing things. But as we said at the beginning, we're looking at the question of how the temporal order shows up. And if you say, we want to understand how the temporal order is established, well, that's not the right way of saying it, because you can only establish within the temporal order. An analogy for that is if you think about a language and all the words in the language, and you say, well, you know, what's the fundamental word or set of words from which all language emerges? Well, in terms of our ordinary understanding, at least, there's no such thing, because every word is defined by other words. And so the moment you start to understand or want to understand a word, you're caught in a circle in which you just go around and look at other words, and then those words look at other words, and eventually perhaps you're led back to the initial set of words. That's like the temporal order, right? Everything depends on everything else. And you can only establish, once you accept the temporal order for language, you could say you can only understand what a word means once you already have a language within which that word can mean something, which is a little paradoxical, but that seems to be the way it is. Right? So the temporal order as such, here in this smallest moment, looking at the whole, at the presupposed readout, right? Nothing is ever really established. And that nature, that not established nature of what is, that takes us to the zero point, which is where we're making the move to the third level. So there's a quote in the text. Find it here. It says, with regard to the presupposed zero point, it says, as the space, I mean, to the bottom of the first paragraph. So we've got this readout, the presupposed readout, and then it says, as the space of the character of unconditioned existence, and unconditioned existence is another way of talking about the fact that nothing can ever be established. You know, conditioned existence is where something arises depending on or conditioned by something else. And if you're familiar with Buddhist philosophy, this will sound kind of familiar, but I don't necessarily want to make that connection. I think that might be misleading, but at least that way of thinking is familiar. And nothing, we're looking at what's unconditioned, whereas in ordinary experience, everything is conditioned. So as the space of the character of unconditioned existence, before the temporal order, but not before in a temporal sense, it, and that the it is the presupposed readout, might best be considered the free dimension of zero. So we have to understand what that means, but at least this is the point where it gets introduced. The presupposed whole, the readout, is best understood, he says here, as the free dimension of zero. And the same thing is true for every point. Every point is a zero point. Nothing is ever established. So this begins to take us toward the practice that I thought we could do today. But what I want to do is first read the next paragraph, because that's where this gets clarified. Up until this point, it's just a little mysterious. And then say a little bit about the practice, and then we'll work with it. So the next paragraph on page 89 says, I'm going to read it, because now it's going to say, okay, so he's introduced the term zero point. Well, what's that? So the next paragraph tells us, in approaching this zero point, we can sense a quality in appearance, a hidden occupancy of time that ordinarily merges into the instant occupancy of experience. This quality could be said to be prior to the structure that identifies moments or designates outsiders. It might be understood as a gateway, a first moment of presence without presupposition, of space that is pure and undisturbed. So it's very interesting in general that in this chapter, when Rinpoche is talking about this third level of time, he keeps kind of pushing towards space. You know, when you contact this unconditioned and invariable, as he says later, this unconditioned and invariable time, that leads you towards space. Maybe we'll say more about that later. But what he's saying here is that within appearance, ordinarily you find what he calls here the instant occupancy of experience. So something, I don't know a better way to say it, you know, I'm just going to say it in more words, I think, but maybe it's helpful. Our experience is what shows up in each moment. Right? I mean, in every moment we experience whatever it is we experience, and that's the content of that moment, you could say. And so there's a kind of, the moment we have experience, it's like we instantly occupy the moment. And that's another way of talking about this, you know, the smallest possible moment and the total presupposed and juxtaposed readout. That's all there in every moment, and that's the instant occupancy of each point. Okay, but when you look at the zero point, then there's a different occupancy, what he calls here a quality in appearance. So it's a quality. It's not something you can point to. It's a quality. A hidden occupancy of time. So there's something going on here that we don't normally experience. It's hidden. And it's hidden because it ordinarily merges, I'm quoting here again, it ordinarily merges into the instant occupancy of experience. So in any moment, there's what's going on, and that's experience. That's, we instantly occupy the moment with experience. And we do that so automatically that we bring time with us. We bring, really what I'm saying here is the third level of time. We bring it with us. So it's hidden. We don't notice it. It's a little bit like, and this is really just a little bit, you know, string theory in physics, which tells us that you have these three dimensions of time, of space rather, but folded into them, hidden in them, are another seven dimensions or eight dimensions or many, many more dimensions. There's no way to access them, you could say. They're hidden, but they have to be there for the whole thing to work. And you could say time is like that, this zero point time. There's this hidden occupancy. And he says that could be a gateway. So this is the reason I'm spending time on this paragraph is because I think it really describes a practice. The practice is going to be seeing if we can engage this quality in appearance, which is a hidden occupancy that is not experience, that is prior. And Rinpoche goes on to say that, you know, another way to talk about that is as being, which is very interesting. On the one hand, he's talked about it as the zero point, but he says what takes occupancy in this moment at the zero of time is being. It is here, yet subtly hidden, an allowing of fullness that does not occupy at all. So this hidden occupancy doesn't occupy in any ordinary sense, but it makes possible. So Rinpoche has a lot of very remarkably evocative and challenging ways of describing this, but I think we've said enough. We'll come back and do this in a moment. I want to say a couple of things about this hidden occupancy, and then we'll practice with it for a few minutes. So first of all, this hidden occupancy is always available, right? That kind of goes without saying, but I want to say it anyway. Nothing is excluded. So another answer to Klaus's question, if zero is zero, how can it show up? Another answer would be to say, if zero is zero, it has to show up. It shows up in everything that appears. Right? Every appearance is the zero point or is the zero appearance. So third level time, you know, it's not that you have some... it's certainly not that you go somewhere else, but it's also not that you have some other experience of time. That might happen. But even if it's within a very ordinary experience, there's this hidden occupancy in which the zero is available. So the zero, when something shows up, it shows up as zero. And the zero affirms what shows up. It doesn't discard it. It doesn't reject it. But it shows up as zero. And so, you know, no special place to go and see. It's available everywhere. The second point that I want to make is there is a tendency sometimes, I think, when you look at this kind of practice, and in some ways, you know, we've already done a lot of practices that have some of this quality. And there's a tendency to look outside you, look at the room around you and so on, and you say, oh, the hidden occupancy of time. You know, can I contact that quality? But it's just as true that hidden occupancy is available in our own reactions, our own judgments, our own emotions. Our reactivity is also the zero point. You know, it's also a presence without presupposition. And that actually is terrifically important, because I think as long as you stay focused on the external, this can stay kind of theoretical. But if you begin to realize that the parts that we like to own and say, this is me and this is my reactions and this is what I care about and this is what makes sense to me, and we realize that all of those are also zero points, that they're all occupied in this hidden way by time, which which in a sense, you know, strips away their claims to identity. When we begin to realize that, then this takes on a really important significance for how we live our lives. And so the other point I want to make is that you know, I've already talked about reactions and judgments and emotions. Those are all also occupied in this hidden way by time, which transforms them into zero. But just to go one step beyond that and kind of maybe bring in the ordinary time dimension a little more, is we're always telling stories about the way things are. We're always making sense of things in terms of stories. And those stories also are structures that in which the hidden occupancy of time frees them into the openness of zero. Caroline says, this seems to be akin to the stillness embedded in the heart of movement, and perhaps vice versa. By vice versa, do you mean the movement embedded in stillness? Yes. Caroline's on video, so I can see her nodding. Yes. Yes, I think there is definitely a connection here. You might, you know, if you find it easier to explore in those terms, I don't think you'd be missing too much, but maybe that's not quite fair to say, especially before we've done the practice, because, you know, the point of the practice is to experiment with these ways of making, not exactly of making sense, to experiment with the possibility of touching this quality. So if we go back again, to what he says in this paragraph, he says, okay, in approaching this zero point, so that's kind of our practice. So if this had a title, this exercise, maybe it would be called Approaching the Zero Point. It's kind of a nice title. And what he says is, in approaching this zero point, we can sense a quality in appearance, a hidden occupancy of time. And that hidden occupancy is prior to experience, it's prior to moments, it's prior to whatever outsiders we encounter. Right? It's a presence without presupposition. And the practice is just, you know, if we look for it, do we get a sense that it's there? Maybe we only have a little glimmer of a sense. But at least by working through these possibilities, you know, there is this prospect that's available to us that wasn't available before, to be able to touch the hidden occupancy of a zero-point time. So if we had started this whole program with this chapter, I think people would be totally lost. But we have had the opportunity to work our way through these different possibilities. And so I think we can have a sense of what to do. Ken asks a question and then we'll do the practice. How can one point out a zero point, which is in itself beyond pointing? Right, you can't point it out. So if you try to do it that way, this exercise is not going to take you very far. But if you look for the hidden occupancy. Okay, so let's do that for about 5 minutes, okay? Okay. So, I'm very interested to know more about how you experience that. So I'll give you all a chance. Okay. Okay, great. So Klaus asks, he's still worrying about zero, which is good. He says, how can zero be prior to anything when anything is zero? Well, there's a very clear answer to that. Let me see if I can say it clearly. A clear answer in terms of what's presented in this chapter. Anything and everything is zero. As Rinpoche says on page 90, he says, form is the exhibition of zero. So what that means, in a sense, is that everything starts off as zero, and it stays zero. But before its form, it's zero, right? So it's prior to everything. But of course, it's not prior in the sense that first there's zero, and then something happens, and it turns into something, right? In terms of our ordinary understanding, you'd have to say it that way. But it's prior in the sense that it's always available, it's always there, it's the ground of everything. So it's a little bit maybe like saying, before you play a movie, you have to have the movie projector and light, and I guess film, but let's not go too far with that image. But the point is, there's something that's presupposed, but it's also always there. You know, what you're seeing when you see the movie, and I guess I've used this image a few times, is in fact the light through which the which projects through the film. So you're always seeing the light. You're never seeing anything other than the light, and it's prior, but it never shows up, right? It only shows up as form, and form becomes the exhibition of zero. So the model is right, of the movie theater. Okay, Caroline writes, diving into the rabbit hole of zero. That's very nice. From an Alice in Wonderland point of view, to the before of existence. Yeah, to the before. And Rinpoche uses the word prior here as kind of a technical term, but prior, before. A boundless, unformed expanse before, behind, underneath everything arising, which allows for an unlimited, variety of possible appearance and innovation. So this boundless, unformed expanse, that's, you know, we say zero. But it's very interesting. I mean, the word, the term zero, or actually the number zero in our numbering system, and Rinpoche talks about this at different places in TSK, it's very interesting because before zero can show up, it has to take form, right, as the zero, as this circle, this closed, you know, this circle. But the fact that it shows up doesn't make the showing up zero. You know, and I don't want to, you know, there's so many different areas that this touches on because we're working at a really deep level, it seems to me. So one area that it touches on is mathematics. And again, it's not something I understand much about, but you know, before you can have our system of arithmetic, at least, you have to have the power of zero, which is what makes it possible to have, you know, units and tens and hundreds and so on. So, again, that's kind of an analogy. Okay. What I was going to say, though, in response to Caroline's description is when you talk about zero, you're talking about a boundless, unformed expanse, but you also don't want to say, well, it's boundless and it's unformed, if by that you're going to separate it out from what is bounded and has form, It's more fundamental than those kinds of distinctions. Okay. Eliana writes, in my understanding, the 0.2, I think, or points out maybe, an occupancy of awareness before the claim to identity. So yes, before the claim to identity, that it's before any kind of claim. That really is the issue, I think. Yeah, well, let me continue to go through here. Before the claim to identity, the quality is first felt as space and then a feel that changes together with the appearance focused by awareness, loose, tight, soft, sharp, luminous, etc. Yeah, well, it's very interesting to bring in awareness. All I'm going to say now is that strikes me as very interesting. I'm not going to comment on it further. And so if you talk about an occupancy, the zero points to an occupancy of awareness, as you say, it would presumably be this hidden occupancy. Right? And Caroline comments on Klaus's questions and my responses. She says it's like talking about different levels of things at the same time, isn't it? Yes, it is. It is. And the prior that Rinpoche talks about, or the appearance as the exhibition or form as the exhibition of zero. Yeah, it's different levels. That's a good way to think about it, and it may help clarify things. Ken says, zero does not have to appropriate anything. It simply allows. Yet zero is not appropriate. Yep. Zero stands apart, you know. Zero, there's another image that Rinpoche uses, I think it's in this book, I'm not totally positive, where he talks about X, and in a way that's not the point because X is not zero, but with respect to X, he says, our understanding of X, at least in English, you say X is the unknown, but at the same time, X marks the spot. X is where things are. Zero is kind of like that, you know. It allows everything, but it stays zero. It doesn't become anything. Now, all of that, that way of talking reminds us of space, it seems to me. And actually, as an assignment for people in the teacher training, if you take a look in the index of this book, you'll see that zero is described with respect to space as well as time. It's interesting to reflect on the difference between the two, and you might want to do that, write about it. Page 245 is actually where you would start to see that discussion. Okay, I want to say we're just about out of time, so I want to make one point. And I'm not sure that what I'm going to say now is accurate, but as I've been thinking in preparation for this class, it seemed to me helpful. And it has to do with applying this whole approach, working with this approach in terms of not just the outsiders in the usual sense, but our own discussion, our own reaction. And that involves things, as we said before, that involves things like perceptions and judgments and emotions. So if you can touch this hidden occupancy, this invariable allowing or exhibition of zero, what happens to something like an emotion? So I was exploring that during this past week, I'm reminded of it by Eliana's comment because she refers to the claim to identity. Right? So zero is before, it's an occupancy before the claim to identity. And I think that is very interesting in terms of our emotionality or our judgments, because let's just stick with emotions. Our emotions, I think, are making a claim. Right? They affirm an identity and they affirm our position, and we respond emotionally to a situation because we are holding on to a position, and that position, in response to everything else that happens, calls forth this emotional response. It all has to do with making a claim. And it seems to me that if you engage the energy of the whole without identity, without making claims, with this kind of hidden occupancy, this time before time, then you don't make a claim. And what happens to the emotion then? Is it that the emotion, what can we say? You know, is it that you somehow reject the emotion? No. It's just that emotionality itself is an expression of this instant occupancy of experience. We occupy experience in a particular way based on claiming that things are a certain way. But if we go to the hidden occupancy of time, then we stay within the range of the whole, and emotionality just is not going to arise in the same way. That's my take on how this works. And I'm actually going to suggest in the transition and orientation that's, you know, work with that as the walkabout for the next 2 weeks. Now, we're not going to have class next Sunday, so we'll resume in 2 weeks. There's plenty to chew on here. Of course, we're right in the middle of this discussion of zero and this section of the book called Zero Emerging Rhythm. But I think it's not a bad place to stop and really try to kind of digest and ask about this hidden occupancy, very mysterious in a sense, but perhaps also very available. So that's it. We will see you, or we will talk again in 2 weeks. Thank you.